The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 76 for October 28th, 2006.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton, and I am actually here with John Braun. Hi, John.
Hey, Dave. Wow, that's... I like doing the intro.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of expected when you're saying greetings that you'd be flailing about more, but you're pretty composed physically
I try to stay composed, that's right. Yeah. Well, you know, we're sitting down now, so sometimes if I'm standing up, it's a little different.
So I am up here in beautiful, rainy, windy... Multiple weather warnings, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So we don't have to worry about Skype delays today, but we do have to worry about phase cancellation, though. I think with these hot, dynamic Heil mics, I don't think either one of us needs to actually worry about that. We've got about 6 feet between us. So we are here this week to talk about all kinds of stuff. Of course, the new MacBook Pros were released this week, and that begs the question of, okay, now they've got the Core 2 Duo in them. Everybody saw the ads on TV. Everybody's read about it. Everybody complained that Apple's the last manufacturer to put this chip in their machines. So now it's there. Does it matter? We're going to talk about, you know, what the differences are, what the impact is. And then we've actually got all kinds of stuff to go through.
And, just a potpourri of, is that the right?
A potpourri, menagerie.
Or no. Menagerie, is it whatever?
I don't know. And don't forget to choke up on that Heil mic there, John.
Mm-hmm.
John's on the PR30. I'm on the PR40. Just for those of you keeping score at home, because to some of you, that may sound crazy to actually mention, there are many of you that actually spend time worrying about that stuff. And that's a good thing because. There's lots of Mac podcasters out there. All right, so Core Duo versus Core 2 Duo. John, what? Talk to me here.
You know, I'm going to talk to you about the first thing. They got to work on their naming. And last I checked, Duo and... It's getting unclear. So you got a Duo and a Duo 2?
But it's not the Duo 2. It's the 2 Duo. It's kind of like...
Is it the 2 Duo?
It's kind of like saying, you know, father-in-law and fathers-in-law. It's not father-in-laws. It's fathers-in-law. It's the same kind of idea.
The Core 2 Duo.
That's right.
The Core Duo 2. But still, it's...
Ridiculous.
They're kind of saying the same thing.
That's
right. Anyways, so what's the big difference? We'll talk about the performance in a moment, but if you look at the actual specs of the chip, there are quite a few differences for those that are into processor design and all that fun stuff. I would say the major things that I saw, so one, the die size got quite a bit larger. They went from about 90 millimeters square to 144. So that's getting a lot larger.
Okay.
The transistor count almost doubled. The original chip is about 150 million transistors. The new one is about 300 million, 291. So they doubled the amount of transistors on
there.
So that's good. And I would
Is it good? Or should I? I'll let you... Go through the thing.
Well, depending on what you do with it, and I'm going to suspect that most of what they did with it is that the new chip has the potential to have, rather than 2 megabytes of cache, level 2 cache, up to 4 megabytes. So as far as talking about big changes on this chip, I mean, we talked about cache at a pretty high level before.
Yep.
And there are also, I mean, we could do weeks worth of shows on cache. I mean,
sure.
There are, you know, lookup algorithms and ways that you can effectively use it.
And, you know, if people want that, they can send us cache, and then we'll do shows on cache.
Oh, you mean the CASH?
Well, if they send us CASH, then we can do more shows on CACHE.
Yes. But anyways, yeah. So suffice to say, without getting into too much detail, that more level 2 cache is better.
Okay.
And this new chip gives you twice as much, has the potential for you to have twice as much.
Okay.
I saw that, and probably, I mean, there's some minor things, you know, pipeline stages, there are more of those, decoders, all these things that, you know, again, the processor people really get excited about. But what I did notice was that the floating point units, whereas the old one seemed to be that it just had a single floating point and addition unit, the new one listed individually floating point multiplication unit, floating point addition unit, floating point storage, and floating point load unit. So it looks like they did quite a bit of work in the floating point arena. So I would think that, you know, things that take advantage of floating point operations.
Like what?
Well, that's a good question. I would think a lot of the graphic filters
yep.
would start to get into that thing.
Okay.
Perhaps some of the audio processing, which could be DSP or...
Yep, okay.
So I'm just taking a stab at what could benefit.
That's what I would have guessed. Sure, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was a good guess. So all in all, I wouldn't say it's a revolution.
Okay.
Like, you know, dual core was. I mean,
sure.
that was a revolution.
That's huge, right.
I mean, you're almost... yeah, I mean, you went way beyond single core chips.
Right.
And I hear... who is it? I think HP is going to be the first people to offer a quad core.
Okay.
And we're going to be seeing that before the end of the year.
Okay.
We should. Probably not from Apple, though. Who knows what Macworld will bring us.
Wouldn't That's
that
right.
be a nice little surprise?
That's right.
So anyways, but then there's another aspect to it. So, you know, for the you know propeller heads who like all the, you know, stats and pipelining and stuff like that, that's one aspect. But then another aspect, and maybe Dave, you could speak to this, is what does it mean to me in terms of performance? I mean... You know, it's a Core 2 Duo. Well,
that's right.
Is it better? I would assume from all the things I just said, it has almost more of almost everything.
Well, you know, my concern would be, okay, we've added all this stuff in, but it is a laptop, or at least we've added all the potential of this
right.
stuff, right? So you talked about, you know, a lot more transistors, a much larger die. Does that make it better with heat? Does that make it worse? I mean, to me, it would seem more transistors, more heat, but larger die, better heat dissipation, right? So,
and same thing, like, for example, the front side bus. I think I mentioned that, but it's can go up to 800. You know, when things go faster, they
hotter.
Typically generate more heat.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you have any figures on the power consumption, but...
I don't. I was looking for that. I can't find anything here.
I mean, if people make breakthroughs as far as, you know, power management units and ways to deal with that. So it'd be nice if you got the additional performance without, you know, paying more
in
battery
heat,
life.
In battery life. That's
heat
right.
And battery life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they may have to tweak the fans.
Yep. That's right.
To deal with that. But I think we had come across something that did some benchmarks, which you always got to take those with a grain of salt, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times they're not real world applications.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you sit down and do a benchmark to test a processor, you're not really, I mean, it doesn't test the speed of the hard drive, you know, the speed of, let's say, the wireless network. Let's say you're downloading stuff and all you care about is how quickly that stuff gets downloaded. Well, a faster processor isn't necessarily going to make a difference there, you know, unless your old processor is bogging things down there. But
mm-hmm.
for most of what most of us do, the processor is not the bottleneck, right? I mean, I run this MacBook Pro all the time, and rarely do I see either or both cores going even close to 100%
right.
for any length of time. Mostly it's paging out to disk, right? You know, which is horrible. And
yeah.
I've got 2 gigs of RAM, but it's not enough. The new ones, I don't know if you noticed, can go up to 3 gigs of RAM.
Hmm.
So that's a selling point right there. But you know, the chip isn't the end all be all when it comes to measuring the speed of the computing experience, which really is what matters in the end.
Right. It's a system level thing, definitely. So
right. Well, and it's also, none of them are going to make you type any faster either, right? So if all
right.
you're doing is writing articles all day, well, you know, there's better places to spend your money.
You may, because I suspect, this must have been the case. I mean, many of the Mac worlds that we went to until they switched to the chips,
mm-hmm.
you would get the idea that all Mac people did is run Gaussian blurs in Photoshop.
That's right.
Because that's the only thing they showed, and I would suspect the one thing that the Mac in general excelled
better.
At.
That's
now,
right.
whether that was engineered that way.
Yeah.
Or somebody...
Yeah, pick the goal, and you can, you know, engineer something faster to get there. So, but from what we saw in the test results that we've seen online, we've got a couple of articles to link to, the Charles Gaba's systemshootouts.org, and then also Anandtech had a pretty good article detailing the differences. They focus more on the Windows side, but really it doesn't matter for the chip itself. And it seems like overall there's about a 10% increase in the reported test. Now, I've seen, you know, Apple has said, oh yeah, this is, you know, 30% faster, 40% faster. Again, it depends on the test, the overall, you know, what they're doing with it. But it seems like it's, you know, it at least 10% faster at the same clock speed than its younger little brother there. But like John said, it's an evolution, certainly not a revolution. And so it comes down to, you know, should this make a difference in your buying decision, right? Because right now we're at kind of the cross, we've got a little bit of overlap. So you've got the MacBook, the old MacBook Pro available through the refurb channel at Apple with significant discounts. And then, of course, you got the new one, no discounts, but faster processor and more options. So you got FireWire 800 in the new one. You can go up to 3 gigs of RAM. You know, so there's some arguments for going there. If the chip is the only thing that's got you on the fence, man, I wouldn't do it. At this point, I'd take the older model MacBook Pro or even the MacBook with the Core Duo chip and go that route.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they have, I believe, I don't know if you mentioned this, but I think there is a FireWire port.
There's a FireWire 800 port. Yep, and also rumors have it that the wireless chip in there is 802.11n, which is significantly faster than 802.11g. Now, Apple's not touting this. They're not selling it that way. The speculation is that, you know, the ITV or whatever that's going to be called is going to use 802.11n, so Apple is, you know, funneling this stuff into the pipeline quietly. It is a different chip than is in the Mac Mini, and that has 802.11n. All this stuff is pre-standard spec stuff, so you know, it's sort of a crapshoot, but that's how the industry works. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would say, you know, hey, if you want to squeak every little bit of power and performance, and you like to get Rev 1.0 hardware, because I would still, well, I don't know. I don't know if I'd say this is Rev 1.0 hardware.
I would call this at least Rev 2.
5?
Well, because we saw a change to the MacBook Pro at some point in there. So I think you're okay going that route. So the other thing they came out with, which was sort of a quiet announcement, but for me was a big deal, is the airline adapter. I don't know if you saw, but now they've got a MagSafe. It's essentially one little cord with the MagSafe on one end and either the cigarette lighter or the, and I can't remember the name of the other adapter, but it's both on the other end. It's convertible to the E-Power, M-Power, I think is what it's called. And it's got both to connect to a plane. Now, Apple's adapter will not charge the battery. It will only power the laptop and it will not run in the car. So, If you want to do either of those two things, you need to go aftermarket. And currently, MikeGyver.com is the only place to do that. And like I said, I've tested this adapter. I'm nearly certain that that if you blow up your laptop doing this and then call Apple and tell them that that's what you did and how you did it, your warranty is likely null and void. So if you're interested in keeping your warranty in tip-top shape, go for the Apple adapter, but know that it's coming with limitations. I have successfully charged and run my laptop while the battery is charging on the MikeGyver adapter for those of you that care. So that's where we are with that. Do you have anything else on this Core X Duo topic, MacBook Pro topic before we move on?
No,
John.
I'm still wondering where Apple got that 39%, though.
I know.
That's what it says on the homepage.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, clearly they've got something to back that number up, but is it real-world experience? You know, I mean, they said it was 5 times faster than the old PowerBook. Again, doing certain things, it is. Running Rosetta apps, it's about the same speed as the old PowerBook. Reading a big file from the hard drive, it's probably not.
I see. Okay. No, I see here. They qualified. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. It's fair. Based on estimated spec int rate base 2000 results for blah, blah. So this is using a specific integer benchmark, I believe.
All right. Well, there you go.
So, okay. So in some cases, hey, if that's all you do,
that's all you do. You know, we've got a new sponsor, which is really an old sponsor coming back to the show, AudioEngineUSA.com. The makers of the fine A5 speakers are back with us. They've got some new stuff coming out. Haven't had a chance to talk to Dave over there a whole lot about what's going on going forward here, but we are welcoming them back to the show. The A5 speakers are $349. It's two separate speakers, self-powered, and you can either power it from your computer, or you can, you know, not power, but you can drive sound from your computer with the little mini eighth jack on the back, or you can plug your iPod into the top and even charge your iPod from the speakers, because it's got a USB jack built for charging only on the top of the left speaker, I believe. They've got two drivers in each of them. Killer, killer sound. I've got them on my desk here. I'm happy to have these folks back as a sponsor. I'm always happy to have a sponsor on board with a product that not only do I think is okay, but I think it's fantastic. And these speakers are fantastic. As you know, I've had them for a while here, use them in the studio all the time, and they hold up great. They sound really good. John, you said you use the A5s with your Airport Express.
Yes, that's another very nice touch, is that they have a power jack on back of one of them. So, of course, you plug them to the wall to power them, but they give you a place to plug in your Airport Express.
Awesome.
So if you're into the audio streaming thing, these are a perfect way to do that.
Killer. All right. And speaking of the iPod and all the crashing, of course, this show, again, is coming to you in stereo because of the iTunes 7 and iPod update crashing issue. Once that's resolved, we likely will not stay in the stereo realm here unless a lot of you tell us that you like it. We've gotten some comments from you that say, yeah, it's fine, but, you know, if given the choice, I don't really care. And that's kind of how we feel about it, too. But we'll have fun with it until then. And Adam actually has a comment about a different type of iPod crashing.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Adam from Boston. I just listened to number 75, and the guy was talking about how his iPod was crashing his Mac. Well, I had a very similar problem. I had a fifth-gen 60-gig video, and for some reason, after I applied the 1.2 update, my iPod actually brought my Mac to a crash. And then I had to hard reboot, and it happened several times, and I was able to trick it to turning back on, because the iPod itself wouldn't necessarily turn on. And took it to the Apple Store, and they found out that it was actually a latent hardware issue that I hadn't had any problems with, but I guess the update triggered malfunctioning hardware. And I had run all the diagnostic tests before, and I hadn't had any problems whatsoever. So he may want to take the iPod to the Apple Store and kind of look at it as a genius part, because it could very well just be broken, but the diagnostics won't detect what's wrong with it. All right, thanks. Have a good day. Bye.
Thank you, Adam. Well, I wanted to share that with everyone just so you all know that things like this can happen. Software updates can expose deficiencies in hardware. We saw this years ago with third-party RAM, right? When Apple released a firmware update for the PowerBooks on a Friday afternoon. And everybody that did the update over the weekend, all of a sudden, not all, but a lot of the third-party RAM that they had, and this was PowerBooks, the black ones, the Lombards, I guess is what it was that this caused problems with. Mm-hmm. But it can happen, and it seems like it's happened here. That's almost exactly what the listener last week described. So, thank you, Adam, for contributing.
So I'm thinking they may have, in addition, the firmware update.
Yep.
They may have also updated the diagnostics, or I'm guessing, you know, the Apple folks in their back room there may have a special utility to check the health of the iPod that's not available to mere mortals.
They probably do. You're probably right. Yeah. Going on, more follow-ups from last week. Brett wrote in, and last week we were talking about the what John likened to the connector conspiracy. From what was that? Connector conspiracy was from the DEC days, isn't that where that started?
Yeah, if you saw the thing I put up there, and it's been happening in the computer world for ages, ever since you got marketing people involved.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, the deal was that you couldn't use just a standard camcorder out cable for your iPod if you wanted to take the iPod with video, the fifth generation, sixth generation, whatever you call it, iPod, and plug it into the RCA jacks on your TV. It wouldn't work. But you could if you changed all the assignments, and it was explained last week. I'm not going to go through it again. We said that this was a conspiracy. In fact, it's not, and Brett explained. He said, with Apple's choice of pinout on the AV cable, it's possible to use the same jack on the iPod for both headphones and AV. As you know, the standard stereo headphone jack has three conductors. The AV cable has four. On the 3.5 millimeter mini plug, and going to three RCA plugs on the other. Meanwhile, long before the iPod video was introduced, there were many camcorders on the market that also used the same type of plug. The problem is that these older camcorder-style cables are not compatible with a standard stereo headphone jack. So, really, it was that Apple was kind of being a little more forward-thinking than we had given them credit for. And it's true. You can't plug headphones into the camcorder jack and hear left and right audio. You'll get a mess. So Apple, the reason Apple did this was simply to allow the jack to have two uses. And and you got to give them credit for that. So thank you, Brett, and hey, thanks, Apple. So there you go.
Yeah.
We'll give them credit where they deserve it.
That's the only downside with competition.
What's that?
Well, sometimes everybody comes up with a... like
it's true, yeah.
Blu-ray, HD DVD,
yep.
Example.
Yeah. And one other thing that I stumbled across this week, there was SMC Fan Control that we talked about last week, which was the little app that let you set the minimum fan speed on the MacBook Pro. And there's a new or another product out that does the same thing called Fan Control. Version 1.1 was at least the one that I saw this week. And it's actually a system preference pane. It runs its little daemon at startup. And the system preference pane lets you set both the minimum speed of the fan and also some thresholds, so you can change how the system reacts to heat. You can say, look, you know, fine, make the minimum speed 1,000 RPM, just like Apple has it, but kick the fan on at a lower temperature and make the high speed of the fan a lower temperature or something. So you really can control how much the fans are being used. Now, you got to do this with caution. You got to think about what you're doing. Figure out, you know, what makes sense to do. You're going to, if you have the fans running more often than Apple suggests, you're going to use more battery life. Presumably, that's the only downside there. If you have them running less often than Apple likes, well, I wouldn't do that. That's going to cause more heat. But this fan control thing, it's actually pretty cool. The defaults that it loads with are not Apple's defaults. So if you're going to use this, be aware that they instantly set the minimum speed up to 1500 and I believe drop the increase down from 60 degrees centigrade to 50 degrees centigrade. So I believe that's the difference between what their defaults are and Apple's. So bear that in mind.
Yeah, and you got to be careful because though a lot of processors and maybe all current ones have a thermal overload where they'll shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I know some, because I've heard stories from some colleagues, some do not. And I know at least one colleague who had a machine, a do-it-yourselfer,
yeah,
where the fan cut out and the particular chip, I think it may have been an earlier AMD chip.
Oh,
and,
sure. Yep.
And it was toast.
Oh, yeah.
So, be careful with these utilities here because I wouldn't want to guarantee that you cannot.
Yeah.
Toaster machine.
Oh, that's right. We had a server machine that was running our ad server actually. One of the fans on the processor was a dual processor machine. It was old AMD chips, and one of the fans burned out. No one noticed, and things got a little toasty in the rack, and it actually burned out not just that processor, but the motherboard and the other processor and the drive controller. Yeah, and I don't know if you saw those two drives stacked down in my office. Those are the drives that were in that machine. We copied them over. We that was the last homegrown machine that we stopped. Now we actually run everything off of Dell's, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So, hey. It works.
Dell's
we're not good. Running Windows. It's not. Let's talk for a second about that.
Let's talk.
John's spending the weekend with us, and he was doing something with my son on the... on the Windows machine that I have in the house for the kids, and it was having trouble printing. And it's printing to a shared printer on the Mac, which has worked in the past, but was giving us trouble. You know, part of my hatred for Windows is, and this is a love-hate thing, because I used to make a lot of money off of exactly this, that you can't troubleshoot it easily. Now, maybe this speaks to the fact that I have my roots in Unix, so OS X is like I've come back home again. But, digging through the registry, it turns out that there was some permissioning issues in the registry and some damaged files. The answer, of course, is just nuke and pave, or maybe just reinstall Service Pack 2. But, why do they make this stuff so difficult? Unix is complex. It's got a lot going on, but it's so structured and straightforward. This registry stuff in Windows, it's a horror show. I mean, I know it's nice, you can cache it and all that stuff, but frankly, the operating system with Unix caches commonly read files and all that stuff too, so what's the difference? I just don't get why it's so much more difficult to troubleshoot on Windows. Again, maybe it's my perspective, maybe it's that, like I said, I spend a lot of time with Unix and have spent a lot of time with Unix over the last 20-something years.
But. I could guess. I mean, one thing is that Windows does strive to be an operating system that can handle almost any peripheral you throw at it.
You know, that's a good point.
I got to give them credit because Apple still Apple has certainly gotten a lot better, but there are some pieces of hardware that just won't show up.
Yeah,
it's just like, huh?
No, you're right, and that's something I've actually been asked to give a session at Macworld on running Windows on your Mac, and I said, okay, well, you know, this isn't something I do a whole lot of, but I've done enough of it, and obviously have some experience with Windows, so sure, I'll do it, and started thinking through, you know, okay, I got to structure this thing, and part of the intro is, you know, yeah, we all say Windows sucks, but there's actually something to be said, like you said, for the way that Windows is able to, remember, Windows is made by one company, the computer is made by another company, and most of the time the peripherals are made by about six more companies. So it's not like, and that's just what comes in the box, right? The graphics card, the all that stuff. Dell's got to go, when Dell sells you a Windows machine, they've got to go and get Windows, which is a known quantity. And then they've got to build all this other stuff into the box, the mouse, the keyboard, the video card, the USB controller, all of that stuff. And Microsoft, it just gives them a copy of Windows. Microsoft, they don't say to Microsoft, and maybe they do, but it, in a general sense, you know, they don't say to Microsoft, okay, go ahead and rebuild Windows for this exact configuration specifically. Mm-hmm. Microsoft doesn't do that. They get a copy of Windows, and Microsoft has to build it such that it's going to be able to take all of the drivers and such that were required to run all this hardware. It's a much more difficult process because you've got so many different companies involved. And Windows, given that, Windows actually doesn't do too badly.
And even the basic code. I think I told you I won't mention the specific product. But yeah. For example, I ran into this issue very recently that I was researching for the 9 to 5, where a USB peripheral, when hooked to certain PCs with certain BIOS,
right,
would wedge the machine. The machine would not start up.
Yep.
As it turns out, the device had a faulty USB descriptor. USB descriptors have a field within them saying, this is how big I am.
Right.
The problem is it gives you the opportunity to be wrong. And what happened is certain machines, so for example, the descriptor could be, and this is, you know, the thing that tells the computer, okay, here's all the capabilities that I have in a nutshell. The problem is, you can have it be larger than the reported length, and this is what was happening, but only certain PCs would wedge on this. Some would say, oh, 32 bytes, you're telling me? Okay, fine. And the device would have send over 64, and the machine would go, boom. Some machines totally ignored it, and they went right past it.
Yeah.
So I think another thing, so you have a variety of BIOS know, akin to firmware,
yep.
Whereas on the Mac, you only have one, so that's
per
one
machine,
less variable.
That's right, yeah.
And every variable you add,
it increases the complexity.
Chaos.
Yeah. You know, we have, to get back on our track here, because I derailed that train. Robert.
Nice rant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why we let it happen. Robert wrote in or sent in a couple of months ago about this weird little icon that he started seeing and couldn't reproduce. And it looks like he may have found it, but we're going to offer him some help.
Hey, guys. It's Robert calling again. I had talked to you a few weeks back about an odd icon that I see when I do a little hovering sometimes over files in the file browser. I've heard, although I have not been able to replicate it still, that this is a dictionary lookup of some sort that's built into the OS, and that if you hold down Option Command D, it will look up the word that you're hovering over in the dictionary. Now, I haven't been able to get that to work, and I still haven't seen that icon, but thought I'd throw that out to you guys and see if you can get that to work, because I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Someone had told me that that's what that's for, but I don't know if I believe him, because I can't replicate the icon again. Anyway. Love the show. Keep it going. Bye.
All right, Robert. Well, that was enough to send us down the right path. Command Option D, as you found, John, does
hides your dock.
Or shows it. That's right.
Yeah, so it toggles between showing and hiding the dock. Because I tried this and I'm like, that's not a magnifying glass.
No. However, a little bit of research, once he mentioned the dictionary thing, revealed Command Control D. If hovered over a word in a Cocoa app, will pop up the definition from the built-in dictionary in OS X. And though I haven't seen the little spotlight icon happen when this happens, I can imagine that perhaps on a slower machine or if it's bogged down doing something else, maybe that, you know, that's the effectively the hourglass for this operation, is that this little, you know, kind of sort of spotlight looking thing pops up while it's fetching the definition. Did it work for you, John?
It's working for me, but I don't see a magnifying glass. Not,
no.
You know, I got to ask you because on the...
You can't
on,
ask me.
I'm going to ask you anyways. You're here. You can't
I can't escape.
Away.
Where's that?
But on the train on the way up when I was, you know, doing some of the research on the show.
Yeah.
I, for the life of me, could not find anywhere within Mac OS X that told you how to do this. I went in the Mac OS X keyboard shortcuts. I went to the dictionary application itself. I couldn't find this documented anywhere. Where did you find this?
Well, I actually, Google. I did a Google search for something along the lines of dictionary keyboard shortcut, and that's how I found it. But and honestly, I don't even remember where it was because it was revealed in the notes on the first Google page that came up. So it was like, oh, let me try it. And bam, I was in Safari. So I just hovered over a word and it worked. It's like, oh, okay. On to the next thing. So there you go. Speaking of which, on to the next thing, we'll let Matt talk a little bit here.
Hey, John and Dave. Matt, California. Just had a follow-up on the Shortcuts podcast. Control F2 is awesome. That allows you to highlight the Apple menu, just the Apple in the upper left-hand corner. This saved my bacon today and saved me before, because if you can't get to the Finder, let's say your mouse is not working, I mean, it's going around, but you can't actually click on anything. If you hit Control F2, it'll actually, you can go up to the menu and then arrow down to force quit, and then force quit the Finder, and you're back. There's probably other ways, but that works really good for me. Also, you have to hold down function key, of course, if you're on a laptop. So function, control, F2. Also, it's real good for GUI scripting. I work on an application that has no Apple script capabilities. So with GUI scripting and control, F2, you can GUI script over to any menu item that you have in that list and do any actions that way. So it's awesome. So thanks again for your podcast. Out.
Hi, John and Dave. It's Dave Reed. Back in show 64, I think, you asked about Quicksilver and Spotlight and some of the other application launchers.
We did.
Quicksilver and Spotlight are really designed for different uses, although you can do some of the same things with both of them. Spotlight indexes both file names and the contents of many file types, such as PDFs, office documents, and so on. Quicksilver indexes only the names of files, not the contents. That's why it's much faster as an application launcher, and for opening files with certain apps. For example, I have lots of LaTeX documents on my hard drive, and what I can do with Quicksilver is type in the first few letters of the file name, and it finds the LaTeX document and then opens it automatically with TechShop, which is the application for editing LaTeX documents. Quicksilver also has many more uses, such as starting an email with an attachment, starting a Google search, showing the contact information for one of the contacts in your address book without actually opening the address book, and many other things. I only scratch the surface of its use, but I don't know how I could live without it. The only thing I use Spotlight for is searching for words within a document. For example, if I know some of the words in a file but can't remember the file name, that's where Spotlight comes in handy. I hope this helps explain some of the differences, and keep up the great show. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks, Dave. That's actually killer advice. And being that I use Spotlight to do exactly that, that was the thing that got me back to install Quicksilver and start using it again. And it's so, so much faster. So thank you.
Yeah, I'll have to try it.
Yeah, it's not bad.
And I do like that control, and thank you for remembering function.
Yeah,
because I still have my PowerBook here. Well, one little caveat to that, though, Ed, that is totally awesome for keyboard scripting.
Yeah.
You may want to. I'm just, you know, thinking like a programmer here. If you're already in that mode and you hit escape, I'm just trying to think how to get you started in a known state. So if you already happen to be in the keyboard selection mode,
then
you want to guarantee.
That's right.
It would look like it could throw. I'm just trying to think, because what he's proposing is probably the only way you can do it if you don't have scripting.
Right.
The problem is if it's already in that mode. So, and I was just goofing around with it while we were doing some of the playback there. So maybe doing an escape before you do the function control F2 may. As far as I can see, that always guarantees that you're gonna, be starting with the Apple.
And, yeah, just hope that there. Hope that the escape doesn't cancel out of a dialogue, right?
Yeah,
that's the concern. So how would you?
Yeah, that's tough.
Well, you'd
man.
Have to. Yeah, you'd have to pull the system for the state of that, and you can't. That's the whole point of needing to use GUI scripting, is that you're trying to do something that's not scriptable to begin with. So,
yeah. So something to toss in there, but yeah. a good tip for things that are not automated or Apple scriptable.
Yep, that's right. That's right. I'm hesitant to. Well, we'll go ahead and answer this question.
Hi, John and Dave. My name is Colin. I'm calling from Poughkeepsie, New York. Big fan of the podcast. I listen to it a lot when I commute to my job in Boston.
Awesome.
Anyhow,
wow.
My question is regarding iTunes libraries. What I want to do is, I have a MacBook Pro with my 80 gigs of music on an external hard drive, and I now have a Mac Mini in the living room at home. And what I want to be able to do is have one library on the external hard drive that I can travel and take with me to Boston, and have the other library on another external hard drive at the Mac Mini in the living room at home. So what I want to be able to do is be able to download new podcasts, buy music, load it onto the external hard drive that I travel with, and then synchronize it with the Mac Mini's external hard drive at home. So I wonder if what the best way to go about that is. Let me see. I guess I could leave you my email address, but then you'll just cut me off, so I won't bother. So maybe you just play this comment on the show. Love it. Thanks. Bye.
I wanted to address that last bit first, and Colin actually did go ahead and send a follow-up message in with his email address, because he realized, wow, even if we do decide to play it on the show, it may be a while, and he wanted his answer sooner rather than later. Now, so let's talk a little bit about what we do with all the email we get. We get a lot. You've got to know this. And we're happy to get every bit of it. We try to, anything that's even remotely globally relevant, and by globally relevant, I mean globally for you, our listeners, right? If it's relevant to enough of a percentage, or it seems to be relevant, we'll put it in the show, certainly. But there's some things that come through that are so, so specific. And a few of them have actually turned out in the show and turned out well, but a lot of them don't. We do actually try to answer a lot of the email that comes through. Certainly there are some that we simply don't get to, and I apologize for that. It's the nature of the beast. But if you're going to send in an audio comment, it's no problem at all. Just say, and my email address is something that warns us. We can pause it just like you hear us do all the time. And if we don't wind up emailing you, that's okay. If we wind up playing it on the show. But if we do, it's a great way. It also allows us the ability to follow up with you. And I've done that with people. You've heard it where, we've got a comment and suddenly our answer is based on a whole lot more background information, and it's because we took the time to email the person that sent it in. So please do continue to do that. You'll just happen to hear us cut it off every now and then. Now, as to Colin's question, this is an issue that I've tried to solve here too, and I stumbled onto an app a couple of months ago that I so desperately have wanted to mention since then, but it's never worked quite right for me, and it's an app called Slingshot from Martian.com. I think it works well for a lot of people. I don't know why it didn't work for me. You tell it, look, sync these, take these playlists. And of course you could make a smart playlist that just included everything and say, take these playlists and sync them with, publish them. And then you go to another computer and you sync back to you install Slingshot on both machines and you tell one to subscribe and one to publish and boom, it works. But it wasn't copying everything over for me. I was actually trying to do it with the audio comments that we use for the Geek Gab so that I didn't have to play them over the network from my MacBook Pro to the studio machine here. But it never was reliable for me. It could be that, I installed one version and then overwrote it with another and had preference issues. Frankly, I never spent a lot of time to research it, and that's why I never mentioned it on the show. But since Colin asked, I figured now's the time. We'll mention it. Martian software is Slingshot. Check it out. If you have problems, let us know. This is also now the catalyst for me to get in touch with them and figure all that out. So there you go.
Yeah. I'll toss out one thing. I don't know if
go ahead.
I directly addressed it, but then, you know, what I say rarely does. It's usually a tangent.
That's why. It's a beautiful thing.
But sometimes they're useful. But there's one thing that I think is kind of a hidden feature in iTunes. Because it sounded like part of this problem, the one way to solve it would be to know when things were added to a particular iTunes library, which if you're clicked on library, you'll typically see that. Or right now,
right.
Of course, in the new iTunes, you have the libraries broken down by category.
Right.
So you'll normally see, like I'm looking right now in iTunes, and I see name, time, artist, album, track, year. That's all great stuff. But if you do control and you click on any of the column headers, well, my goodness, you'll get this amazing list of things you can see.
Really?
Yes, you can. Have you ever seen this?
Oh, okay. So this is the same as going to the...
maybe somewhere else.
The edit menu, what was it, in iTunes?
I'm not even sure.
Menu and view options lets you pick the different columns. That's
same thing. So this is a bit more direct, but if you click in one of those column headers, and there's one thing here, date added. As well as a whole bunch of other stuff. Now, I think they picked, you know, the core set of things.
And you
that
even
you
have
really
date
want.
Modified, too. So if you have, if you went and changed something, you could also do. And I would guess, though I would have to confirm this, date modified, it should be date added until it's modified, right? So you could search only by date modified, right? Right?
That would seem reasonable.
I think so. Yeah. Date modified is not blank for anything I've got here. So yeah, it is. If it hasn't been changed since it was added, it stays, so date modified would be the thing to use.
Yeah, now what they used to have, it's still here. Now, this is another handy one, and a little tangent, but I think it's very useful. There's a kind field.
Right.
Now, kind comes in handy, especially if you want to find out which files you have are your purchase music and which are your MP3s, because typically it'll have the word protected.
Unless it's a podcast. Podcasts. Okay. AAC podcasts like ours will show up in iTunes as a protected file. And let me tell you, it's not protected. There's no problem. I went nuts when we first converted that first AAC, but no, it's not protected. But it helps you narrow it down. Yeah,
well,
for sure.
It's good also if you want to, especially if you want to move files among devices, since, you know, of course, not all devices support, for example, AAC.
Right. That's true. That's true. Yeah.
So a handy little bonus there to get iTunes to just tell you everything it knows about what you got stored in it.
Cool. What are we? Do we have? Oh, no, we're out. Right, we're good. I think we're good, right? Time-wise?
Yeah. I'm good. You good?
I'm good. I'm good. We're good. All right. So I, again, want to thank our sponsor, AudioEngineUSA.com. Very happy to have
them. Who are these guys
back.
Pushing me out of the way?
They'd only be pushing you out of the way if we panned them to the right, John. But we'll keep them in the middle. They'll push us both out of the way. Cashfly Hosting, of course, is the place where you download this show. Mm-hmm. And our podcast marketplace does include the A5 desktop speakers from AudioEngineUSA.com. It includes the 6i Isolator earphones from Etymotic, which I believe I can see in your ears at the moment, John.
Yes, fine, fine earphones.
And TeachMac from TeachMac.com. Go ahead and use their module maker to make a Geek Gab module. Maybe the Control-F2 keyboard shortcut thing wouldn't be a bad one. Next week, we will be back on track. My guess is we'll be back on track for a Monday night show and have all kinds of stuff. Make sure to send your comments in to MacGeekGab@MacObserver.com or they can call 206-666-GEEK. It's so much easier to sync that up when we can see each other.
Yeah, there are downsides to being able to see each other, too.
Like when I get to make faces at John while he's talking to you all. So, I guess that's it. I don't have anything else. Play Nation States. It's a lot of fun. And somebody's got to take the delegate position from me.
I don't know if I want to deal with that level of responsibility.
Vote for John. He's definitely a much better delegate than I am. Screaming blueberries forever.
That's right.
I think so.
Voting. Talk about voting.
Yeah, well, it'll be November 1st this week. So, yeah, head over to Podcast Alley and let's see what we can show him for the 11th month of 2006. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's it. I'm good. Let's get out. Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah.
Nothing more to tell them? MacObserver.com/podcast or MacGeekGab.com is where the show notes will appear so quickly you'll be amazed.
Oh. I think there's one more thing.
Is there one more thing? All right. We do sit here and give you a lot of advice. If you had one last bit of advice, John, for him before we let him go, what would that be?
For goodness sake, don't get caught.
That's good advice.
Made up.